This is a BBC podcast. You can get all our podcasts and our terms of use at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello from Boston. I'm Marco Werman, and this is Boston Calling from the BBC. It's a program that puts a global perspective on the American experience. Good to have you with us. This week, becoming an American citizen.
There was one point where I just actually considered never getting my citizenship when George W. Bush was in office. No way.
But those who do want to call themselves American had better know their U.S. history.
The Federalist Papers were written by whom?
I think I know. Also, what's the secret behind the Asian hot sauce that's really hot in America?
I use sriracha pretty much every day with breakfast. I love sriracha with eggs.
You should try it on pizza. First, though, we're going to spend a good chunk of Boston Calling this week finding out what it takes to become an American citizen. According to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, more than 750,000 immigrants were sworn in as citizens last year. If this year's rate keeps up with that, that number will exceed 1 million by the end of the year. For most immigrants, the process goes something like this. If you're a permanent U.S. resident and have lived here for 5 years with a document known as a green card, and if you don't have a criminal record, and you fill in some forms, pay some fees, get fingerprinted, it should take a year or so to get your citizenship. But that's not how it works for everyone. In this report from Monica Campbell, we meet a man who waited 11 years to become an American.
My name is Tariq Hamdi. I'm originally from Egypt. I came to the United States in 1977.
I met Hamdi at a cafe in L.A. He's tall, with a black beard, and he's a Muslim. He was 18 when he left Egypt to study engineering here, and he stayed, found work, met his wife, had kids. He had a green card for years and didn't think much about citizenship until September 11th.
The calamity that had befallen this country, it tugged at my heart emotionally, and it made me feel no longer as an Egyptian, but as a citizen of this country.
In October 2001, he applied through the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. He was told he'd hear about his swearing-in ceremony soon.
It didn't come in 2002. It didn't come in 2003. I started going to immigration. I started talking to them on the phone. Every single time they said they could not find my file. Go get your fingerprints taken once again. I must have done the fingerprints and the pictures at least 5 to 7 times.
Hamdi says it was like fighting a ghost. But he knew that Arab and Muslim men faced extra scrutiny post 9/11. So he stuck with it. For Hamdi, becoming a citizen meant being able to vote, no risk of deportation, and visiting his family in Egypt without worry. But in 2008, his application was denied. He didn't know it then, but he was on an FBI list, a list that could include people like Hamdi, never convicted of anything. Years before, he donated to an Islamic charity, thinking it helped refugees. The FBI later said the charity funded terrorists and duped donors like Hamdi. But that link placed Hamdi's application on a separate immigration track run by a new program. It's called Controlled Application Review and Resolution Program, or CARP. And it has immigration cross-checking its list of people applying for citizenship with the FBI's.
The CARP policy creates an additional barrier because it puts people on this track where they're purposely delayed.
That's Paul Chavez with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights in San Francisco. He's working with the ACLU to pull the curtain on what CARP does. Through records requests, the ACLU found some of the triggers that can place applications like Hamdi's on the CARP track, from traveling to, quote, suspicious countries, wiring money, attending certain mosques, or, like Hamdi, giving to a charity flagged by the FBI.
One of the biggest problems we have with it is that you don't know, and there's no method in place to address it.
USCIS says CARP is about vetting, not profiling. Chris Bentley is a spokesman.
I think that due diligence, if you will, is something that not only do immigrants expect of us, but the United States public expects of that as well.
Hamdi agrees, partly.
They should check the backgrounds, but if somebody like myself has been living in this country for over 35 years, I've not had one conflict with the local police or the FBI, and for me to be cast as somebody that's suspicious, that's a waste of resources, a waste of time, a waste of money.
It took Hamdi 11 years, but a federal judge finally ruled him eligible for citizenship last year. She swore him in on the spot. Hamdi knows he's an exception. But it's unclear how many people like him are still waiting for their citizenship or have given up.
Monica Campbell reporting there from Los Angeles. More than 8 million people are living in the United States with green cards. These are legal permanent residents who, after a waiting period, are eligible to become American citizens. But less than 38% actually go through with it. That's low compared with some other nations. For example, Canada has a naturalization rate of 89%. In the second of three citizenship stories that we have for you this week, Nina Porzucchi looks at why some people who could become Americans don't.
Angel Riono has lived in the U.S. as a legal permanent resident for more than a decade. She studied here, married an American, and has no intention of moving back to her homeland, Taiwan.
I am, for the most part, more American than I am Taiwanese.
Still, when it comes to taking the next step and becoming a U.S. citizen, she's been on the fence.
There was one point where I just actually considered never getting my citizenship when George W. Bush was in office. No way. But nowadays, I feel much more inclined to apply for my citizenship.
So leaning towards citizenship, but still undecided. Full disclosure, I know Angel Riono from high school when her name was Angel Chang. She was one of the smart kids. She applied for early admission to Smith College, and she was political, hanging out with the kids sporting lefty buttons and Che t-shirts. But what I didn't know about Angel was that she was undocumented. Turns out she didn't really know herself until she was 17, and she told her parents that she just received a full ride to Smith.
I wasn't expecting them to have a disturbed look and a worried look on their face, and that was when they told me that I can't receive the scholarship and I cannot go to Smith because I don't have documents.
That moment at 17 changed her life. Angel didn't go to Smith. Instead, at 18, she married her high school sweetheart and began the green card process on her own.
I waited in line, went to all the meetings, and attended the interviews.
The process left a bitter taste in her mouth. And Angel is far from alone, says Joanne Gottesman, a professor of immigration law at Rutgers University in Camden.
There is a little bit of a fear of the immigration process, you know, because these are people who went through it to get their green cards. And, they realize how complicated the bureaucracy is and how daunting the paperwork can be.
The paperwork can be intimidating, beginning with the N-400 form. It literally helps determine one of the requirements needed to become a citizen.
You also need to have good moral character.
So how do you judge moral character?
It's asking everything from, have you ever had a parking ticket? Have you ever been a prostitute, I believe, is one of the questions.
Randy Shemelsky coordinates Citizenship Rutgers, a free service in New Jersey that helps immigrants fill out the N-400. But, says immigration lawyer Joanne Gottesman, even after helping many, many people fill out the form,
we found that even at the end of the day, after having completed their paperwork, they simply weren't filing because they couldn't afford the cost.
It costs $680 just to file the form. That's about 2 weeks of minimum wage work in some states. And that's not including any lawyer fees. But for Angel, the fees or ticking a box about her political affiliations isn't really what's keeping her from going for citizenship. It's pegged to her experience navigating the immigration system and to one single day nearly a decade ago when she was waiting in yet another line to get her green card. She watched as a family standing next to her was told to go back home.
And then explained to them, we lost your file. You just have to file all the papers over again. It's very emotional.
An emotional, expensive, bureaucratic nightmare. Still, Angel says she will get around to it, just when the timing feels right.
That report from Nina Porzucchi. Now, we haven't even mentioned the exam that would-be Americans have to pass before they become U.S. citizens. Yep, there's a test. Nearly everyone who takes it passes, but they spend hours and hours in special classes designed to help them memorize material on the exam. Critics, and there are many, have called the test arbitrary and unfair. The weekday program I present for American listeners sent Sam Harnett to find out more.
The best way to prepare for the U.S. citizenship test is memorization, memorization, memorization.
What is the highest court in the United States?
The Supreme Court. Yes.
How many justices are on the Supreme Court?
Nine.
This prep class in Utica, New York, is like your worst nightmare of an eighth grade history lesson. But it's not junior high. The room is filled with immigrants, and they're preparing for their citizenship exam. The federal agency that creates and administers this test is the USCIS. A few years ago, it spent millions revamping the exam, trying to make it less about memorization. Julie Gluleven doesn't think they succeeded.
It's kind of sad, but that's just the kind of test it is.
Gluleven moved to the U.S. from France in 1998. She passed the citizenship test by cramming the night before. But for people not fluent in English, the test is a challenge. Take Amu, a 62-year-old refugee from Burma. I met her in the classroom in Utica, New York, preparing for the test. Her brain, she says, just isn't what it used to be.
I want to get more opportunity in U.S., but I need to try more.
The citizenship test has two parts. An English language section with reading, speaking, and writing, and a civics part with 100 possible questions. Some are easy, like who's the president of the U.S.? Others are tougher, like this doozy.
The Federalist Papers were written by whom?
Paula Winky is a professor of second language studies at Michigan State University. She says Americans can't even answer questions like this, so it shouldn't be on the exam. Winky's done research to determine if the exam is a good standardized test. Her premise is that the exam should prove that an immigrant's civics knowledge matches that of an average U.S. citizen. But Winky says that's not the case.
I think we've got 10 items that are working really well and 90 that are not.
Winky found that U.S. citizens only perform noticeably better than immigrants on local governance questions, like who's your House representative? Testing is a science. Normally, exam companies release a technical test manual. It's a public document that explains things like how the questions are developed and how the exam is run. But USCIS spokesperson Daniel Cosgrove says it's a mistake to compare the citizenship test with, say, the SATs. He says immigrants gain valuable knowledge through studying.
The study materials on our Citizenship Resource Center prepare applicants for a life of engaged citizenship, not simply to pass a test.
Recently, the USCIS announced nearly $10 million to fund innovative test prep courses, ones that give applicants context and engage them. But many immigrants say the test is still about memorization. Eric Cohen has a different idea. Offer an option besides the test.
Someone could opt out of taking the test and instead actually take a class.
Cohen is director of the Immigrant Legal Resource Center in San Francisco.
It could be an engaging class, which not only covers U.S. history and government, but also real civics, how to volunteer, how to engage in voting, how to read a proposition, etc.
Things, he argues, would really help immigrants engage in life in America, not just facts to memorize.
Why does the flag have 50 stars? Because one star.
Back in Utica, Amu, the refugee from Burma, continues to cram. If she passes the test, she'll be the first person in her family with U.S. citizenship. After that, she'll probably never be asked again who wrote the Federalist Papers.
I got that one, by the way. James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and, well, it was John Jay, but my editor had to remind me. Still, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. I knew the 50 stars question. And Sam Harnett's report concludes our dive into citizenship this week, though there are more immigrants' tales to come. After, I remind you that this is Boston Calling on the BBC World Service with me, Marco Werman. We're an offshoot of a weekday program I present for American radio listeners called The World. It's produced by the BBC in conjunction with Public Radio International and WGBH here in Boston. Coming up, an American witness to the aftermath of a tragedy off the Italian coast.
Fishermen are afraid of throwing their nets and catching bodies of people that drown. Bodies that have yet to be rescued.
Visiting Italy's island of death, still ahead. Before that, a troubling tale a little closer to home for us here in Boston. Just north of here, in Concord, in the state of New Hampshire, anonymous hate messages like, "You're not welcome," and "You're proven to be subhuman," had been appearing on the homes of African refugees. The graffiti, usually written in black marker, began around 2 years ago. The police were stumped. Then came the news that they'd made an arrest. John Duvall is a Concord police chief. He told me that the detective in charge of the case found a clue in the graffiti itself. The letter B was written like the number 6.
We knew that we had unique handwriting, that if we could find something similar, that would be probably our best lead. And the investigator was looking through reports that we had taken in that neighborhood, going back a few years, even before the date of these crimes, looking for anything that was similar. and he was hitting dead ends until one report he was looking at had a copy of a gun permit. It was just any old gun permit, but what he noticed is that it was handwritten. And he started with the letter A and just methodically was just looking at writing. And when he got to that letter B that looked like a number 6, he said it was just an absolute match. And then the investigation focused from that point forward.
So the African community that the suspect was allegedly targeting, I mean, how shaken up were they by these writings, this graffiti?
Them waking up to these crimes was significant because they understand what it's like to be targeted. In fact, back in their country, if they found writings on the wall, that was usually a precursor for being killed. So the messaging for them was that somebody is singling us out.
I mean, that narrative you tell of Africans waking up and finding writing on their walls, threatening writing, that would have happened, especially among Rwandans, I imagine.
Exactly. Their fears were steeped with experiences that many, if not all of us in this country, can only imagine with horror. And here they are looking for a place to start over again, to establish their life and bring with them their culture. And they wake up to this type of messaging. And it was quite, it rocked our community. But the people in this community appreciate individuals' rights and respecting others' dignity. And I was proud to be the police chief. I also live in this city. And people came out of the woodwork to express their dissatisfaction with this type of behavior and their resolve to be active about speaking about it, but in a positive way.
Concord Police Chief John Duval there. Now for another story involving African refugees, this one from Italy. Earlier this month, hundreds of men, women, and children, all migrants, died when the boat they were traveling in capsized off the Italian island of Lampedusa. A memorial service for the victims was held this past week. The tragedy rang all too familiar for Valeria Fernandez. She's an American reporter based in the U.S. Southwest and happened to be on holiday in Italy when the sinking occurred. Valeria often covers tragic stories of migrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border from her base in Phoenix in the state of Arizona. Valeria told me that when she heard about the capsizing, she knew she had to get down to Lampedusa.
When I heard the news, it was October 3rd, I was in Florence. Being that I come from a border state and I've been covering immigration issues for the last decade, I really couldn't help but go.
So you get to the island of Lampedusa, and what did you see? What were people telling you?
Well, I'm in the plane about to land, and the first thing that strikes me is that there's no fishermen in the sea. And the reason is because the fishermen are afraid of throwing their nets and catching bodies of people that drown, bodies that have yet to be rescued. That gives you a sense of the degree of trauma and shock that they were experiencing. Just a few hours later, after I land, some of the local people take me to the port, and there were all these coffins being transported into a Navy boat, dozens and dozens of them.
I mean, it sounds like the kind of thing that would just completely consume the island. I mean, that's probably all they think about and talk about for weeks.
This is exactly what's going on. I mean, you get in the bus, the radio is on talking about it. You go to a restaurant and you see it because you have the local people, you know, sharing food, trying to help these refugees. And the refugees are everywhere in the island. And the thing is, there is this degree of solidarity and generosity coming from Lampedusans that is really, you know, heartwarming to see in the midst of the tragedy.
I was just going to say, so how bottomless is that generosity?
Well, I mean, there is a sense of frustration from the locals, but it's not with the refugee, but it's with the Italian government, the European community. They feel alone. They feel that the state is absent. The island livelihood is tourism. And Lampedusa, on the headlines, is known as the island of death. You know, I was talking to one of the women that helped in the rescue. She was there in a boat near the island, just, you know, having a nice evening with her friends. She heard the sound of what she thought were seagulls. They walked out and they see three people in the water. And when they turn around, they realize it's dozens, hundreds that are swimming, and they help 47 of them get into this tiny, tiny little boat as they call the coastal guard and for support. I mean, this is how raw the situation was and how close it was to the island.
Valeria, you report from the U.S.-Mexico border, as we said, and, you know, it's your curiosity from that beat that, in a way, drove you to Lampedusa while you're on vacation in Italy. I'm wondering, was there a moment when you were in Lampedusa where you just stopped and said, wow, this is exactly like Southwest U.S.?
Just when you talk to the survivors and they tell you the reasons why they're coming to Europe. They have a family in Eritrea that they want to support, and they know that just having one person in Europe can make a difference between life and death in their country. And it's the same story that I hear in Spanish when I talk from people from Central America and Mexico. They want to give their families a better life. And this is the thing, this is the biggest parallel of all. Once the tragedy happened, they turn the page and they're ready to move on because they have so much at stake that all they can do is look forward. You see the same thing in the desert. People go through a lot of hardship. Once they arrive in Arizona, very few of them want to talk about it. It's all about moving forward to help their family.
Valeria Fernandez is a Phoenix-based reporter who covers the U.S.-Mexico border. She's just returned from the Italian island of Lampedusa, site of a recent immigrant boat wreck that killed more than 300 people. Valeria, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Marco.
For our final story on this immigration edition of Boston Calling, how immigrants have influenced Americans' eating habits. I've been pretty upfront on this program about my love of food, and now I'll share with you something that I always keep in my refrigerator. It's a kind of sauce. It's red, and it's not ketchup. It comes in a clear plastic bottle with a green needle nose cap and a rooster printed on the front. It's a type of hot sauce called sriracha. It's thought to be a Vietnamese sauce. The truth is, it comes from California. That much I knew, but I've long wondered who's behind it, and how did this stuff become so ubiquitous on America's dining tables? Enter Roberto Ferdman. He's written about sriracha for the online news site Quartz.
Sriracha is not the name of the brand. Hoi Fung is the name of the company, and they make a version of sriracha, which is kind of the equivalent of saying, like, barbecue sauce in Vietnam. It's basically a type of sauce that's used to put in pho. However, David Tran, who's the founder of Hoi Fung, made his own version that's come to be known as sriracha. So in the U.S., sriracha means pretty much one thing, and it's Hoi Fung sriracha.
Right. And if you go to Vietnam, generally speaking, you would find some kind of hot sauce to put in your pho. That was the market that Tran was trying to approach, right?
That's very true, yes. So Tran is originally from Vietnam, although his family is from China originally. He took a boat to Boston in 1979. And eventually made his way down to Los Angeles, where he founded Hoi Fung in 1980. When he started making sriracha, it was basically an attempt to bring this sauce that he liked so much from home to the U.S., and not just to himself, but also to the Vietnamese community in Los Angeles.
So give us the kind of deconstruction of the brand, the iconography of this. There's a rooster on the bottle and Hoi Fung itself, the name of the company. They're both significant to David Tran, right?
Yeah, people take it for granted, but the bottle is very much deliberate. Hoi Fung is the name of the freighter that David Tran took from Vietnam to Boston in 1979. And then the rooster is his astrological sign. So there's a significance to both of those. And then you'll notice that the bottle looks kind of like the chili peppers that they use. They use red jalapenos that have, green stems, kind of like the green cap. The body of the pepper is red, kind of like the sriracha bottle is red.
And the red jalapeno that David Tran uses for this hot sauce, this very recognizable hot sauce, that seems to be what sets this sauce apart from everything else, that these are fresh red jalapenos.
Fresh is actually the right word. People don't generally know a whole lot about how hot sauces are made. I think that's a fair assumption. But most are made with dried chilies, and it just makes production a lot easier. Hoi Fung, rather, makes their sriracha using fresh chilies. It means that they have to bottle the peppers or process them within a day of picking them. So their factory needs to be very near where they harvest their peppers. And it's actually played a significant role in the growth and really the cap on the company's growth.
Well, it hasn't impeded the growth by any means, doing this, because I gather that last year David Tran sold 20 million bottles of sriracha, and he's never advertised his product. Why not?
Those two are actually pretty closely tied together, the fact they use fresh chilies and the fact that they've never advertised. David told me that they've grown in the double digits since 1980 annually. That number, however, could presumably be higher because since they rely on using fresh chilies, they can't make bottles of sriracha unless they have enough chilies, and they haven't been able to produce enough chilies to meet demand. That's why they can't advertise. If you were to advertise, he would basically tempt more people into wanting to buy sriracha and upset a bunch of people who wouldn't be able to get the product because there simply isn't enough of it.
Is this an accident? Is he an unwitting, kind of very smart businessman, or is he just kind of like drifting through this whole thing, I just want to make hot sauce kind of attitude?
Definitely, it seems from having spoken to David that the main driver of his enthusiasm about the company and his continued involvement in it is just his love for the sauce and his love for making it. He's been approached many times to sell the company, has not budged. There's something really endearing about it, and I think that it's helped brew this kind of cult culture behind it.
Are you a fan of Sriracha Roberto, or are you just writing about it?
I use sriracha pretty much every day with breakfast. I love sriracha with eggs.
Roberto Ferdman, journalist and sriracha connoisseur. He recently profiled the creator of Hoi Fong Sriracha Hot Sauce for the online news site Quartz. Roberto, great to speak with you. Thanks a lot.
Great speaking with you, too. Thank you for having me.
That interview first ran earlier this week on the program I present for American radio listeners. Since then, I've received a deluge of comments. One listener corrected my pronunciation of the spicy sauce I called sriracha. He said it should be sriracha. Others wrote that the sauce isn't originally from Vietnam, but Thailand. Well, if you have any insight, feel free to pop over to facebook.com/BBC World Service. I'm staying out of it because, well, we're out of time. Boston Calling is produced for the BBC by PRI's The World. From me, Marco Werman, and the rest of our team here in Boston, have a great week.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. The details of them all go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.